Greetings, everyone. First of all, a time check, an audio check, making sure you can hear me. Yes, fantastic. Ooh, thumbs up, lots of thumbs up. Perfect. Great. And I'd like to make an announcement before the Dharma talk. And that is about both a reality and a useful concept called time. More specifically, a time change that is going to be happening tomorrow. The daylight savings time is going to end, and magically, we get an extra hour in the US. So if you are joining from other countries, please adjust accordingly. So speaking of both in some ways a reality and in some ways a concept that's useful and sometimes maybe not useful, the talk tonight is about anatta, about not self. Or self, or not self. So, not self is one of those teachings in Buddhism that gets people to scratch their heads at first when they hear about it. Perhaps then for a long time, it brings up some confusion, brings up some yearning, even sometimes. That not self thing sounds pretty wild or cool. I want myself wants that not self. So my hope in this talk today, in this offering, in these reflections today, is to hopefully shed some more light. And also offer us a way to practice with this in a practical way, not relate to it in a heady way, which is not helpful and counterproductive, actually, for this teaching, for all teachings of the Buddha, but this one in particular. But really relate to it from a felt sense, from a first-person experience. So, with terminology, first thing I want to say is with anatta, atta, the word for self, the word for center, and the I in front of it, the negation, the not self. Some people refer to it as no self. And first and foremost, I want to say that's not a helpful translation. That's not a helpful way to relate to it, because no self is like no self. There is no self. The mind can fall into a trap of trying to deny self, or trying to get rid of self. And I've seen practitioners who are trying to deny that they have a self. They try to deny themselves. And questions come up that, do I not exist? Do I exist? So the Buddha never said that the self does not exist. So yes, we exist. Of course we exist. There is a self, and we have a body and an address and a name and relatives. And so not to deny that at all. And yet on some level, there are ways to see ourselves that can be more helpful, that can be more conducive to living a free life, to living with more freedom, with more love, with more care for others and ourselves. In fact, with this, with the teaching of not self, the story in one of the suttas is that Vachagotta, the wanderer, approached the Buddha and asked him, "Does the self exist?" The Buddha didn't answer. And then he asked the Buddha again. First he asked, "Does the self exist?" The Buddha did not answer. And after a while he asked, "Does the self not exist?" The Buddha didn't answer either. And when the Buddha didn't answer him either times, he got up and walked away. And after he left, Ananda wondered, "Buddha, you didn't answer him. Why didn't you answer his questions?" And that's really relevant for us. Seems like a koan, but it's really relevant here. And the Buddha said that, "Behold, Ananda, if I had answered that the self existed, it takes the side with eternalism. And self in this sutta, the word is atta, which is self, which is where the self, soul, personality, it all coalesces and it's continuous and it's non-changing and it's forever exists. So here the Buddha says, if I had said that atta exists, then I would have taken side with eternalism. Had I answered that the atta does not exist, then it would have taken sides with nihilism, Ananda. If the answer does not benefit Vachagotta and it makes him even more confused, I had better not answer." So here the Buddha is really trying to be wise, take the middle way between eternalism. It's an eternal self, doesn't change. It's here, whatever we do, it's fixed, it's passed on. This is self-centered. It's this contracted thing. So on the other hand, it just doesn't exist. Just does not exist at all. Nothing matters. No atta. So anatta is somewhere. It's somewhere in the middle. It's neither of those two ends. It's the middle way. It's the middle way. And I'd like to present to you in this talk the relationship between dependent co-arising, that all things dependently co-arise because of this, that is, because of all the causes and conditions, this arises. It's held together because of all the causes and conditions that have come. It has come to be. And if it isn't for all the causes and conditions, this thing wouldn't be. So one way to relate to anatta is through codependent arising. All of this is codependently arisen, the self, codependently arisen. So leave that on a post-it note. I'll say more about this. So one way to relate to anatta through codependent arising. And also to say that there are many different ways to understand this teaching of anatta. There's so many different ways. And one way also that can arise for people, in fact, fat folks who practice, whose main practice is metta, cultivating love, cultivating a goodwill, insight to anatta, to not self can arise from practicing love, from practicing metta. And the way that it can arise from that door is, oh, it has a different flavor, as a flavor of, it's not about me. It's not all about me. Somehow their sense of separation falls away between the self and others. It's not just about me, me, me. I want this. I want to get this. I don't want that. There's a sense of, it's not all about me. And their sense of service, there's a sense of love comes through. So love can give rise to insight into anatta, and insight into anatta is not self, which is also an insight into sunyata or emptiness, as I'll talk about it more later, can also give rise to metta, to love, to compassion. So with the wisdom teaching, entering this anatta, this wisdom teaching from not the hard qualities, which again I'll talk about more, but I wanted to bring in because it's so important not to think that there's only one way to understand or have an insight into anatta. So many ways. Coming back to this, the wisdom way in, one way that Richard Gombrich, the author of What the Buddha Thought, he suggests to think of not self as no unchanging self, no unchanging self. And that is one way where anatta relates to anicca, impermanence, the truth of change, inconstancy. And in fact, the three characteristics are all different manifestations of one another. It's like a diamond. The teachings are like a diamond, these three characteristics. And depending on which side the light shines through, a practitioner can see a different aspect of it. And if you turn your head a little bit, well, you see another aspect of it. But they're all the same thing. They're all connected. And this diamond has all the teachings, especially the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta, which are the three different expressions of sunyata, emptiness of self and phenomena, and codependent arising. It's all in one beautiful jewel. So, the way the three characteristics are, actually, let me say a little more about anatta itself and then go to describing how the three are closely related. So, anatta itself. So, anatta, no unchanging self. No unchanging self. Our bodies, our feelings, our thoughts, our dispositions, our consciousness, the five khandhas, the five heaps, the five aggregates, all changing all the time, changing all the time. As a process, as an ever-changing process, not to be taken so personally. It's a process not to be taken personally, born of causes and conditions. If I was born as any of you, if you were born as me, with my genetics, with my causes and conditions, with my upbringing, with all my life experiences and genes and parents and education, etc., you would be me. It's not so personal. I would be you. It's born the self that we take so personally. It's born of all these causes and conditions. It's codependently arisen. My upset, my anger, my sadness, my pain, it's all codependently arisen because of all the causes and conditions. It's not so personal. And yet we take it personally sometimes. I'm a bad meditator. I am a good meditator. I am this. I am bad. I am terrible. I never get this. I. So this teaching of anatta actually can give us some spaciousness to see the causes and conditions and do less selfing, what is called selfing, to do less selfing. There is a sense of freedom in that. There is a sense of freedom. Again, it's not about denying that we exist. Yes, we exist. There is suffering, all of that. And yet, seeing all these causes and conditions, this changing self conditions arising and passing, oh, brings a sense of freedom. Oh, yes, it's not so personal. It's not so personal. So one way to think of the self, this atta, is this codependent arisen process, codependent arisen process. And the word process, turns out there was no word in Pali in ancient India for the word process. Now we have process and algorithm. So to understand this, I'd like to offer a few examples. Both are from biology in some ways. So this, I read a quote to you from the National Geographic magazine. This is by Peter Miller. Let's see if you see similarities here. Of how a self can be a process, an emergent property of the elements, constituents of a whole that function together well according to predefined rules, dharma, the way things are, So how these things, these thoughts, these feelings, emotions, consciousness, they all work together according to rules or dhamma. And then this a functioning whole emerges from these interactions without any single element or any single element orchestrating, without a homunculus meaning a little man, a small person. There's no homunculus in our brain, like watching and orchestrating, like, oh yeah, do this, you think that. It's like it's all coming together, codependently arisen. So here's the quote from Peter Miller, National Geographic magazine. He says, I used to think ants knew what they were doing. The ones marching across my kitchen counter looked so confident. I just figured they had a plan, knew where they were going and what needed to be done. How else could ants organize highways, build elaborate nests, stage epic raids, and do all the other things ants do? Turns out I was wrong. Ants aren't clever little engineers, architects, or warriors after all, at least not as individuals. When it comes to deciding what to do next, most ants don't have a clue. If you watch an ant try to accomplish something, you'll be impressed by how inept it is, says Deborah Gordon, the biologist at Stanford University. Even with 500,000 ants, The colony functions just fine with no management at all, at least none that we would recognize. It relies instead upon countless interactions between individual ants, each of which is following simple rules of thumb. Scientists describe such a system as self-organizing. Self-organizing system. And hence, the sense of intelligence system arises from simple rules, from the dharma of antness, the rules of antness working together. Without orchestration. Another example is that can really depict this is if you've ever seen a swarm of birds, can look like a dark cloud in the sky or a school of fish, which seem to swim as a unit and can change direction very rapidly and suddenly, as if a single entity. Living here in the Bay Area, there is the Palo Alto Baylands, there are a lot of birds, and I've gone there walking, and remember some months ago, one evening, there were swarms of birds. It was just incredible. It's as if they were being directed, and there was orchestra. They seemed to be, again, flying with such intentionality this way, and suddenly they would change path, etc. So scientists have wondered if there is a mastermind, an orchestrator, or whether they pass the baton to each other. And they've studied the patterns because the patterns seem so intelligent. They seem so well coordinated and so fast. And it turns out that there isn't such a coordination. It's actually what has been termed swarm intelligence, which is a collective behavior of decentralized self-organizing system. So the flocking emerges, this orchestration emerges from very simple rules that each bird is instinctively follows. You can think of it as the dharma of being a bird. The dharma of birdness, the rules of being a bird, is keep a precise distance away from your nearest neighbor. Stay aligned with your nearest neighbor. Avoid predators. So these simple rules of birdness, dharma of birdness, as they follow these simple rules of just with respect to their nearest neighbor, then these emergent property of, wow, this amazing orchestration in the sky emerges. So can we see, can we relate to this amazing, incredible orchestration of mind and thoughts and body and digestion and memories and all of this arising as an emergent property of these five aggregates arising according to the natural law of conditionality, according to the natural law of codependent arising, where various arisings condition other arisings. So, yes, given that I'm feeling sick, I didn't get a lot of sleep last night, this body didn't get a lot of sleep, and maybe, you know, let's say there's, I don't know, there's, you know, not feeling well, there is some bacteria or virus. Of course, these causes and conditions will bring to being sleepiness, fatigue, being grumpy, grumpiness in the mind today. Of course, it's all dependently arising. Instead of going, oh, I'm so grumpy, I'm a terrible meditator, and gosh, I wanted to sit this retreat and I'm just lousy and it's all my fault and see what's happening and this is terrible. And it's like, wow, it's all causes and conditions. It's okay. It's okay. It's not personal. It's not personal. So by breaking up the seeming unity or compactness of things and persons, which is one invitation in this practice, when there is a sense of stability, which we've been talking about a lot on this retreat, when there is a sense of stability, this compactness can be broken up. In Pali, Gana, Vinibhoga, this compactness could be broken through seeing, through clear seeing. Oh yes, this is arising, that is arising, this is here, this is here. Seeing it, first person experience, instead of this compactness of, I'm a bad meditator, or this is terrible, I'm just suffering. Like, you get to see the causes and conditions. You get to break the compactness the same way that you'll see individual birds. Oh yes, this one is moving a little bit. And then this one, because this one moves, that one moves a little, and that one moves a little. Like, oh wow. And then it seems like, whew, it's all moving. So breaking the compactness, slowing it down. Through practice, we can slow it down and have investigation, Dhamma Vichaya, sense of, again, investigation is not in the mind. It's not a heady endeavor. It's a sense of seeing with our bodies, with our hearts, with our minds, seeing with our hearts and minds. And one can see when the mind gets quiet, and one can see that, oh yes, sounds arise. For example, sounds arise. And the sound is heard, or it's called ear consciousness. The sound is heard. Hearing happens. Or the sensation in the body is felt. I've an invitation through the retreat. Receive the sensations, receive the breath as if the body is an organ of perception. At least one of you asked about this choice of words. The body as an organ of perception. The body itself senses. Sensation sensed. Ah, there's a sense of, ah, there's no need for this story making, for the homunculus to make a story of good, bad, good sensation, bad. Like, it's right. It's just sensation arises. The body as an organ of perception. Simple. And maybe unpleasant sensation. Oh, that too. Unpleasant. Or pleasant sensation. It simplifies things. It's just, there's so much ease. There's so much freedom that can come from seeing this. So, I have so many notes. This is such a rich topic. So, I want to see what would be helpful to speak about next, given limited time. So, maybe what I'll speak about next is a couple of different words that are used or ways to relate to this concept of anatta, not self, suggested seeing it as a process, as impersonal. A couple of other words that could be helpful is ungovernable, ungovernable. That we are not the owner. We are not the owner of this body, of this mind. You probably know that. I mean, you've been sitting for days, and yes, you intend, you sit with intention for the mind to be still. Do you own your mind? Did you own your mind every minute of this retreat? Did it act the way you wanted to? Quiet mind, did it just say, oh yeah, you own me, you govern me, yes, intentions govern me? It's ungovernable, born of causes and conditions, born of causes and conditions. This body, born of causes and conditions, it's ungovernable. Okay, intend not to age. Okay, stop it now. Don't get sick. It's ungovernable. It's not personal. It's just, it's this miracle of this body, this mind, this heart. Such a miracle. So for us to have humility, for us to have awe, for us to have awe, instead of it's personal, it's mine, it's my fault, it's mine. That doesn't free us from wholesome intention, because just as it is codependent arising with intention, we can set the wholesome conditions in place, which is why we practice. We try to incline the heart, we incline the mind, we incline the body, our speech, we set the conditions in place for wholesomeness to arise. We try to jiggle and shift and change the conditions. That's what we can do, and that's what we can take responsibility for, which is beautiful. It's wonderful. And as many of you have noticed, again, say with samadhi, with quote-unquote concentration. Not my favorite translation of samadhi, the mind settling, the unification of mind. No, we want unification of mind, say many of us come to retreat. And yet, it's not something to get, something to do. In some ways, it is ungovernable. And yet, as many of you have experienced and practiced, you put the conditions in place. Relax, see, you gently begin again with care, with love. You lean into the goodness in your heart, the delight. You set the conditions in place. You set the conditions in place. And codependently arisen is, oh, wow, look, the mind is settling. Wow. Delight is arising. The mind is settling. Codependently arising. And yet, try to get it. Try to get samadhi. Try, yes, I'm going to get it. It doesn't work. See, all of this is related to one another. Anatta is not this weird teaching that's saved for, graduation, or it's all related. It's part of the teachings, it's part of the invitations that we give you every morning in the instructions. It's woven through the Dharma, this impersonality, ungovernability. So I'd like to say a few words about what I planted earlier, which is the relationship between the three characteristics. So anicca, inconstancy, impermanence. What is impermanent, what constantly changes all the time, by definition is ungovernable. So therefore, anicca and anatta are related in that way. It's impersonal, ungovernable. Similarly, what changes and shifts all the time, anicca, cannot be satisfactory, cannot provide satisfaction forever and ever and ever, because it changes. It's just going to change. If you like ice cream, or frozen yogurt, or any frozen, or chocolate, I'll go with my favorite, chocolate. Okay, if you like chocolate, you eat a little bit of it, it's pleasant. You keep eating. And after a while, it's not so pleasant anymore. It changes. Or with frozen desserts, you get a headache. It changes. It's not satisfactory all the time. It changes the nature of experience, the codependent arising. The nature changes. So change, inconstancy, anicca is related to dukkha, inherent unsatisfactoriness. Nothing is inherently in this world, inherently forever stays the same, stays satisfactory. Relationships change. They go through rough times. Yeah, they do. Relationships with ourselves goes through rough times. Unsatisfactoriness, dukkha. And anatta is really another term for, it's another, you know, this gem, this diamond I mentioned earlier. Anatta is another term for sunyata, for emptiness. Of self, and of course, emptiness of phenomena. So it's another way to see the codependent arising of all things, not just internally in this being, but externally in the world. It's all codependently arisen. There isn't a core, there's a hollowness. And as Gail mentioned, these three characteristics are the three doorways into awakening, into freedom. These are the doorways. It's not around them. It's not pushing them aside. It's through them. And since it came up, the question came up in last night's drop-in Q&A, the entry door for dukkha is called the wishless, L-E-S-S, not wish list, as some might have heard, wishless. As Gil said, that there's nothing to run after, nothing to attain, nothing to want. There's this seeing insight into dukkha and satisfactoriness. The heart lets go. The heart lets go. Like, this teaching of non-grasping. The heart doesn't grasp. The mind doesn't grasp. It becomes wishless. It becomes free. The doorway of the anicca doorway, it's also called the signless doorway. It keeps changing. There is no sign. It keeps changing. It keeps changing, keeps being as one contemplates and sits with the changing nature. It keeps changing, keeps changing. There is no mark. There is no sign. There is no signless. Think of it as, you know, when something has a name, has a sign, you know, for example, I have a name, Nikki, that's my sign. Think of it as that way. So when things keep changing, keep shape shifting, the mind realizes, wow, there's a hollowness, corelessness, there is signless. It's not even constant enough for it to even have a sign, a name, an identity, which also relates to anatta, the emptiness doorway, the emptiness doorway, corelessness doorway. It's no core. And also, some teachings associate being a wisdom follower with the anatta doorway, being a faith follower with the dukkha doorway. And that makes sense, right? Because remember with linear dependent arising that I mentioned a couple of talks ago or last talk, liberative linear, my nerdiness is coming through, liberative dependent arising, with the teaching of liberative dependent arising, the first step is dukkha. Dukkha leads to faith. Faith leads to gladness. So dukkha, realizing dukkha, sitting with dukkha and seeing that this practice actually, oh, this works. Something shifts and changes. Faith comes in. So the term faith follower, or more teachings on this, is associated with this doorway. And then dharma follower, dhamma, the way things are. This term, if you might have heard, it is associated with anicca, impermanence, things. It's the way things are. The way things are is that they keep changing. They keep changing. It's the dharma. So a couple of pointers, I think I've already provided pointers as to how to practice with this, how to practice with this. So one way to practice is what we've already invited you, which is as you tune into anicca and dukkha, that is, when you tune into change, it keeps changing, the breath, the emotions, sensations, they keep changing, they keep arising and passing away. And the mind, first person experience, not present, not past, not future, not thinking about it, but first person experience. Wow, it's ungovernable. It's not personal. It just keeps changing. Insight into anatta can arise from that in that way. And also with dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness. And with the seeing how grasping, how holding, there is this holding can also be synonymous with selfing. Because usually the stories are about me, myself, and I when we're grasping. Notice, see that. The instructions that Gil gave with see the grasping and that grasping, that tightness is synonymous with dukkha. And see how actually selfing, it's about me, this is what it says about me, myself and I, what others think about me, what I think about me. See how selfing is in there too. Selfing is in there too. The story of me, me, me. And notice when there is identification in daily life. You can do this practice in daily life, not a high level of samadhi is required. Let the sense of unease be your guide. Let the sense of unease be your guide. This energetic contraction, lack of ease in the mind and the heart. If there is an identification with something, is there a self being created in the moment? My practice, my concentration, my attainment, my. Just notice with kindness. Notice with kindness. Notice how it's, oh, yes, here it is, selfing. Oh, hello, old friend. Oh, yeah, this is how the mind evolutionarily sees. That's why this is practice. That's why it's awakening from the habitual ways that we operate evolutionarily may not be, it doesn't really benefit us evolutionary to perhaps to see this. Just as long as we mate and pass down our genes, I think nature is happy. So this waking up takes some doing, takes some seeing. So again, impermanence can be a gateway, and dukkha can be a gateway. That selfing is like this. Again, don't bring aversion to the selfing if you notice it. Oh, selfing is like this. Notice the contraction around it. Oh, yeah, selfing is like this. Interesting. And notice the difference. Like, I am moving, I am breathing, I am. Instead of, oh, just moving. Coalescing all these causes and conditions together. Moving is happening. And again, don't take that to, you know, some people can take that to a really unhealthy extent, but just enough to have insights into it. You know, this invitation, let me be clear what I mean. So it's interesting to notice, to see that personalizing me, it's all about me, is not necessary, it's not needed. And yet don't let that become a denial of self. So that's where the wisdom comes in. That's where the wisdom comes in. Don't deny that, yes, there is a being is suffering, and yet see if there is a contraction around me. So there's a happy medium there, then, and let wisdom be your guide. And you will know, trust your heart, trust your body. Where there's contraction, there's more selfing. And there are so many ways to see anatta. There are so many ways. There is not one way. So let's have humility. Let's have humility about this being that is myself, about this body, this mind and heart. And as I said earlier, put it on a post-it note, the practice of anatta, seeing insight into anatta, can lead to a sense of love and care and metta. It's not all about me. It's, oh, this conditionality born of causes and conditions for this being and for all beings. And still, there is suffering, there is pain, there is sorrow. Both can coexist with one another. Compassion can coexist with anatta. You don't become a robot. Not at all. In fact, there will be more room, more space for love and care to come through. When there is a sense that it's not so personal, I could be you, you could be me. The way you suffer could be my suffering. It is my suffering. Things can shift. So that's why the practices of the heart go throughout this retreat. As I mentioned earlier, they support the arising of these insights and the arising of these insights give rise to the hard qualities. They are not, hard qualities are just for some practitioners. They're an essential part of the path. They're an essential part of the path. And again, to say there's so many different ways to have insight into this. And however amount of insight arises, bow to it, have humility, and continue to be curious that there are more ways it can deepen. And sometimes it can feel like the rug has been pulled from under us, like, wait a minute, there is no one driving this bus. Wow, there is no one driving the bus. It can be an insight into that, which can actually be unsettling. I remember the very first time years ago I had an insight. I was shaking and trembling. Like, oh, wait, nobody's driving this bus. Wait a minute. It was just very unsettling. And and yet still, I could still feel and be, you know, nothing internally. The sensations are still there, but something opens up. Something opens up into seeing the self and others and conditionality differently. So there is so much more to say, but I think that is plenty, plenty more notes. Maybe I will leave you with one poem. This is a translation of a Rumi poem or by Coleman Barks, or rather I would say, because Coleman Barks has a way of not just translating, but taking different parts of Rumi poems and coalescing them together. And me being Persian, sometimes I try to find the translations and they're all over the place and they're very creative translations. So anyway, that's a long way of saying the poem I'm about to read is attributed to Rumi, but it's a creative translation of Coleman Barks. So here it is. Let it wash over you. Essence is emptiness, everything else accidental. Emptiness brings peace to your loving. Everything else dis-ease. In this world of trickery, emptiness is what your heart wants. Emptiness brings peace to your loving. Emptiness brings peace to your loving. Those are the words I would like to leave you with. Emptiness brings peace to your loving. So thank you all for your kind attention. May there be peace in your loving. Thank you.